Welcome back to the Silver Screen podcast, where we spill the tea on Hollywood's most glittering gambles. And today, we're diving into the high-stakes world of underground poker with Molly's Game. It's a movie where Jessica Chastain plays a woman so sharp she could deal cards with a flick of her wit alone. Aaron Sorkin's snappy dialogue keeps the chips clinking, and you'll find yourself all in before you even realize it. But is this a winning hand, or does it fold under the pressure? Let's shuffle through the drama, the scandals, and of course, Idris Elba in a suit, because as most women will tell you, that's a jackpot within itself.
Wow. Yeah, that is.
I have done plenty of research for this one, but first let me start out by saying that this was kind of a choice of one of our guests here today, which we'll get into. So let me introduce first of all the first of our three guests who are going to break this down with me. Please welcome the person who chose this movie, Toby. Welcome.
Hi, welcome. Live from Amazon, it appears, because
your birds are quite hyperactive.
And now they just decided something happened.
They really liked the movie and they want to chip in. In case you aren't aware, we are joined by kind of the Discord crew, three of my very good friends. So as well as Toby, please welcome, as alluded to, Sandy. Welcome back, Sandra.
Yay! Thank you.
Welcome. And also, hopefully going all in with us, welcome, Adrienne.
Hello, everyone.
Hello. That's the extent of my poker lingo, so I'll probably just say that about 20 times. I don't know. Raise, call, whatever. So anyway, as I said, we are here to talk about the movie of Molly's Game, but I have had a very deep dive into it because I got way too interested in the story, and I have read 90% of the book as well, so we may end up discussing some of the realities of it and some of the things in Molly's own words, potentially, if it's related to the movie, but we're here primarily to review that. So with that in mind, as we always do, I'm going to start by asking everyone if this is the first time you saw the movie, or if not, what you kind of initially thought of it, and when did you first see it? So Toby, I'll start with you, because I'm guessing you're probably the one that I can confirm has definitely seen this before.
I watched it in cinema, actually, and it was very late night. I think it probably was even just midnight. It wasn't like it's release day and that sort of stuff, but you know, sometimes happens with like Marvel movies. It was just random at 1 midnight. It was the only time the movie was running for some reason. Yeah. Maybe it was just because I was too late to the party and it already ran at normal times weeks earlier. I don't know. But I saw the trailer and wanted to watch it, so I was like, okay, I'm going to go at midnight. Who cares? I have time.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair enough. Because I was kind of curious, if you don't mind me asking, what was it that kind of drew you to the film and what made you want to watch it? Was there are you particularly a fan of Sorkin or any of the actors? Did you know the story? What was it that made you in?
I think I probably just saw the trailer like before a different movie and thought, oh, that looks interesting. I want to watch it. I mean, that's cool. Always what happens with me in movies. Like, I barely know people.
Yeah.
You could ask me, who are the actors? I'm like, I don't know. And even worse for directors.
Fair enough. We'll come over to you then, Sandy, and ask you, is this the first time that you've seen this movie?
It is. Yes, I saw it a few weeks ago, several weeks ago. Actually, when my parents came over and stepdad was fixing the dryer, and I usually put on something for me and mom to watch, and I was looking for something that we both enjoy. And I remembered, actually, that Toby had suggested this film, and we all promised we would check it out, and I was the last one, and so I put it on. Oh, I weren't? Okay. And so I put it on, and I was like, oh, you know, really got drawn into it. I didn't expect to. I had been putting it off because I didn't do any reading on it, and I just didn't think it was a subject matter that would draw me in, but I was wrong, and watched it all with my parents, and then just watched it again recently and got even more from it.
Yeah, it feels like it might be the kind of thing which improves on a second watch, because no, you wouldn't have been the last one. I literally watched it like a week ago, well, 6 days ago, I think, in preparation for doing this podcast, because I knew that the time would come and I'd finally was able to. I've just about finished all the editing and work that I've got to do. So like I said, I watched the film, and then about 2 days ago, the book came, and I've been compelled to almost finish that in 2 days because it hooks you in. It's a very quick read. But anyway, enough about that. So without spoilers, then, your initial reaction when you saw the film, was it positive or negative or kind of in the middle?
It was kind of in the middle. because I didn't watch the last like maybe 40 minutes. My parents had to leave and then I went on, moved on to other things. And then when I sat down and watched it again, when I got to the ending, it was surprisingly a piece that many other critics had their only issue with the film is actually what brought it home for me.
Wow. Oh, I think the ending was the best part as well, I have to say. So spoiler alert for that, but fair enough. So yeah, what about you then, Adrienne? Was this the first time that you saw the movie on Toby's suggestion?
Yeah, Toby had been asking about it. Had we ever seen it? Had we ever seen it? And I looked it up because he was talking about it. And I said, oh yeah, that movie. But I knew that there was a movie about it, but I had never watched it at all.
Cool, fair enough. I have to say, I had actually bought the movie before Toby suggested it because it was on sale. I think it was in one of the Amazon sales for like £2 on Blu-ray or something random. And I was like, oh, I'll buy it. I'll give it a watch sometime. But I don't know if I would have done if Toby hadn't suggested it. So at least that gave me, you know, at least it was on the shelf ready and I had an excuse for buying it in that case.
Yeah, that's cool. So, it's like, oh, I got it right here.
Absolutely, yeah. Cool. And was there anything that drew you in particularly or any kind of, what was your first experience? Was it more positive or...
For sure, I probably wouldn't have been intrigued at all if it was not a true story.
Yeah.
The fact that it's a true story just absolutely sucked me in. And I happen to love Idris Elba, so that's amazing. but also, I was completely addicted to the West Wing for about 5 years. I just kept watching all my favorite episodes over and over and over, so I love Aaron Sorkin.
I never watched The West Wing, but I adore Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, which got like 12 episodes, I think, before being cancelled. But yeah, I mean, we'll talk more about Aaron Sorkin. I'm sure that will come up. So yeah, what else is there to say? Except we're going to jump into looking at Molly's Game. And we will start, as always, with a behind the scenes section. I'm going to be the one doing this because normally it would be DK, but he's not here. Because he clearly, you know, he chipped out or I don't know, what would you call it? He lost all his money and ran off home.
He folded. Oh, he did not. Okay.
Folded. There we go.
We miss you, DK.
He'll be back, don't worry. I'll mention that when he's back at the end of the episode. But yeah, so I'm going to jump into the behind the scenes. Apologies if it's not as good as DK's normal dulcet tones. But yeah, just to give you some background, then Molly's Game is a 2017 American biographical film. As we said, it is written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. It's his directorial debut, but he has written movies before, most notably The Social Network. Quite famous, and the movie is based on the 2014 memoir of the same name by actor Molly Bloom, which, as I said, I almost read. The film is based on the true story of Molly Bloom, an Olympic class skier who ran the world's most exclusive high-stakes poker game and became an FBI target. In the movie, Michael Cera's character Player X is a composite character based on celebrity gamblers including Tobey Maguire, Leonardo DiCaprio and Ben Affleck, but mostly Tobey Maguire. During one of the earlier poker games in the movie, one of the players can be seen wearing headphones. This is presumably a nod to Leonardo DiCaprio, who according to the book wore headphones and listened to music while playing during Molly's early games, supposedly so as not to be distracted. Idris Elba's character is a character who does not exist in real life or in the book. He's kind of a composite of various things, but Aaron Sorkin didn't even interview any of Molly's actual lawyers. He kind of wanted this to be the one fictional element and represent Sorkin's point of view in the movie. His character works for the fictional law firm of Gage Whitney. Gage Whitney, also called Gage Whitney Pace, appears multiple times in Aaron Sorkin's work. In The West Wing, Sam Seaborn worked there before joining the Bartlett presidential campaign. I'm sure Adrienne knows all about that. Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip and The Newsroom also mentioned the firm. So yeah, so that's basically all I've got, because like I said, there's not really a lot to this without getting really into things, because it is a very incredibly accurate true story. So we'd be talking about the events of the film, I think, if we dive any further. So yeah, with that in mind, I'm going to move straight to the writing and the plot and then just, you know, the general overview of the film and ask if anybody has any initial thoughts on the, you know, whether it be this overall true story or the way the film's written.
I always forget how much I love Sorkin's dialogue.
Really? Okay, fair enough. Are you a fan of like The West Wing or something like that in the past as well?
No, more like A Few Good Men and some of the other things he's written.
I didn't know he wrote that one, but okay.
And I didn't watch all of The West Wing. I don't really remember it, and I didn't really watch many of his other shows. But there's a few other things I'm just not bringing to memory right now. But that's one of my favorite things about this film is the witty, snappy dialogue.
Yeah, that's fair enough. I'll be honest, it's one of the things that kind of didn't really work for me in the film, because it just seems Sorkin is fantastic, don't get me wrong, but at times it feels like he can be a bit too pretentious. And it just feels like it's one of those things where it comes off really kind of cool and sharp and whatever, but nobody really talks like that. So it kind of hurt the reality of the situation for me at times, even though there are a surprising number of things that did, according to the memoir, actually happen. Like the incident with the, you know, the bagels being thrown at her and stuff like that is apparently entirely true. That did actually happen, which pretty much shocked me, to be honest, that anybody would go on like that. But yeah, anyway, Toby, you wanted to chime in and say something.
Well, now I have several things.
Wait, okay, go for it.
So first I address the writing. The dialogue did work for me in this instance. Like, I kind of get where you're coming from, and in other movies, it from Sorkin, it can be very distracting. I really hated that in, I don't know if anyone has seen it here, Being the Ricardos. It was like the, it was based on this, like, I Love Lucy set, and then it
based
was like,
on, yeah, Lucy,
the Red Scare thing. Like, I don't know the details. I hated that movie.
Fair enough.
But I think it works here because, I mean, it's poker. It's supposed to be cool. Like, we're playing poker. This whole vibe of this movie is just cool. It works in that setting. Yeah.
It's not so much the dialogue that jars with me. I think it's more the narration, because it just seems so, like, pithy, I guess. And it's kind of like, I don't know. It's a bit too proud of itself. Oftentimes, but anyway, regardless, what were you going to say other than that?
Yeah, and in general, I love the structure of cutting back and forth from past to present and the way it's done at multiple instances. That's one thing I really like.
I have a few kind of notes on the themes and kind of the moral questions coming out of the movie. So the first one would be, like, when it comes to ethics and ambition, how do you kind of feel that Molly's game portrays the ethical dilemmas in high stakes gambling? Is there any particular moment that stood out that spoke to that for you? And do you think Molly was justified in her eventual decision to break the law and take a rake, as it were? And if you need that explaining, I'm happy to do it, because I had to look it up. So if you want me to go into how it crossed the line into illegal and what that actually all entails, do say so.
I don't know if it does come across the same way in the book, but in the movie, comes across at times when there's, like, someone losing a lot of money and she's like, oh, no, you shouldn't do that. Like, it seems that she just does this little talk more like a role play of, oh, I have to do this to be good, to feel good, to have done this. And then by the slightest pushback, she's like, okay, yeah, good, continue.
So do you think that her ethics were kind of slipping maybe as she got more, I guess, seduced by the world of glamour and everything?
I think it's more like her ethics were already kind of broken before, but it's just the situation closed in on her and then she had to push further. I think that's.
So you think she kind of got in maybe out of her depth, or the situation itself kind of forced her hand?
Yeah, and I think that's also pretty much portrayed in the movie, where, like, the last part before she gets caught, it's really fast. Like the part, it starts already when she goes to New York, the pacing picks up. But then at the time where she's, like, attacked and all, the pacing really ramps up.
Yeah, that's all stuff that either isn't in the book or I haven't gotten to yet, because, as I said, the book, there's, like, a 3-year gap between the book and the movie where things were still happening. So, yeah, it's kind of a bizarre one. But, yeah, I see what you mean. That was kind of one of the things that also not so much bothered me, but that kind of that I wasn't loving, was I didn't find it easy to follow the movie at times. as to what was going on. And like I said, I had to look up exactly what it was that Molly had done that was illegal, or you know, what they were kind of all referring to. I still don't understand the likes of the poker terms and stuff, despite the best efforts to try and make it simple and have the on-screen graphics explaining it and stuff. I was lost completely in that world. So yeah, because it's not something I know anything about.
Yeah, okay, I can see that.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Yeah, so I mean, I probably should explain for the audience anyway, just in case anybody doesn't know. The thing that kind of tipped the line, as it were, into illegal behavior with Molly was that she decided to, what they call, take a rake, which is basically that she takes a certain percentage of everything that people are gambling for herself, which is what they do in professional casinos legally, because they have license to do it in like Vegas or if they're running professional games. But it's actually illegal to do without like a gambling license or something along those lines. So basically when she decided to do that, because I mean, depending on your point of view, she either had to because she was losing so much money by extending credit, or she got greedy, or whatever. Whatever your opinion may be, that was kind of what officially tipped it into being an illegal operation. And yeah, from there, I don't really know the whole stuff about, you know, the mob and what kind of all that connected to, because like I said, the movie and book are very unclear about what actually went on there and how that became a huge thing. But yeah, so anyway, ladies, Adrienne or Sandy, any thoughts from any of these things from you?
Yeah, I did think that, like you mentioned, she was a bit out of her depth, really. She wasn't like a card shark, a poker player. She was, you know, a celebrity of sorts. But I think she did those things more to assuage her guilt. But also, she came in, she saw this guy losing so much money, the look on her face. And so she's like, well, you know, let me get you some help. Let me, you know, do this for you. Let me get you a book so that you can learn. Let me get you a coach so that you can learn how to play. While she was being manipulated, you know, things she didn't know that were going on at her table were going on, such as him just kind of using her poker table as a fishing spot for him to get people for his fake hedge fund. Bad brat,
right,
that is. Yeah. But I think it was done more to assuage her guilt, and there was something as far as her character that she basks in her own moral compass, so to speak. You know, this is based on her memoir, and it's, to a certain extent, it's Aaron Sorkin speaking through her lawyer, like you mentioned, about what a good person she is and how she has these moral standards she's not willing to compromise. But it was, you know, just the fact that she was portrayed as being so selfless, and like now how she talks about how, oh, everything I do is, you know, just so I can do good in the world. I don't know. People don't need to say that. They just do that typically. So it does come off as a little bit egotistic to me.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, was in the extent of kind of, do we necessarily believe everything about the way the film portrays Molly? Because I'll be honest, she's practically sainted, you know, for the majority of the film, and a lot of it is kind of like, I'm not sure I believe any of this stuff happened. Like you mentioned, I think, was it Toby, you were kind of alluding to the idea that when the, I forget the chap's name, but the guy who's supposed to be going home for his wife's birthday, and he ends up gambling and getting way too far into debt, and she's kind of like, I'll send you home. I'll get you into Gamblers Anonymous. I'll get you some help and everything. There's no mention of any of that in the book. I have a feeling that didn't happen. Basically, I think it feels like that was invented to make her look good in the movie. You know, I mean, I could be wrong, and I'm not out here to slander her or anything, but there were countless instances like that, like you said, which was just kind of like, oh, you're so good. Oh, you so did the right thing. Although, like you said, at least to its credit, unlike the book, it does actually have her acknowledge that she did use an awful lot of kind of drugs and alcohol and stuff to be able to keep going and stay awake and keep running these games. So,
yeah. And that was an excuse, though, right? Like, I just only did these drugs because I needed to stay awake and I needed to alternatively sleep. That's kind of an excuse or justification for it, right?
Yeah, I mean, addiction is what it is, whether it could start that way and then spiral into something else. But it's quite telling that she kind of owns up to her dad in the movie and says, I'm an alcoholic, I can't drink, which is kind of an interesting admission to make, really, you know. But Yeah. It's quite a funny response when he's like, it's hot chocolate. You know, how bad was your head injury? Are you seeing cocktail waitresses right now? Are we in a bar? You know, but yeah, anyway. What about you, Adrian? Any thoughts on any of the kind of the moral or ethical implications involved here?
Yeah, this is very moral centric. You know, she came to LA to enter the big show, and the big show got too big. She got over her head, and then, you know, she has to try to find a way out. And this is just how the story goes. I mean, I'm sure she probably did have some issues with when she just figured out that, you know, these are gambling addicts and I'm making money off it. And I'm sure she cared somewhat about the people, but you know, the lure of it, the money of it, all the bad guys involved. Yeah, I'm just glad she got out with her life, to be honest.
Yeah.
Especially
yeah,
after definitely. The Russian mafia got involved.
I'm never quite sure. It's very unclear which, because it seems like she mentions, I think, being attacked by the Italian mob in the movie, but it's the Russian mob in kind of most stories she tells about it. So I'm not 100% sure what the kind of.
Well, we'll just say by heavy-handed people. Yeah. People that use heavy-handed tactics. I'm just glad made it out.
I'm not disputing that it definitely would have happened, that it would have been horrifying.
Oh, yeah,
you know, not we should all be so lucky never to have to go through anything like that. It would be the absolute worst. But yeah, I mean, so back to the original question, though, like I said, the decision, you know, whether it be spur of the moment or not to take that rake was what pushed it into illegal. But Molly, you know, in interviews and in the book and whatnot, and to an extent in the movie, kind of explains it was a necessary thing because she was extending lines of credit and she was swallowing, or what do you call it? She was eating whole debts of like $250,000 sometimes at a time that people couldn't pay, and she was having to account for. And, you know, she had the expense of putting this on and the 24/7 work and everything. So she kind of tries to justify it, I think, a little bit. But do you feel like that was justified, or do you think it really was like you effed up at that point too much, you know?
Yeah, just too much, too big. I mean, she's trying to survive, and you just have to make bad choices, I guess. Yeah, she had to take that turn. I don't think she wanted to, but she saw a way out.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's... Sorry. Oh, sorry.
No, okay.
I just want to say that she just is really... She really wants to hold up her own moral compass. Because the movie tells that she could have just hired someone to get the money, but she's like, no, I don't want to do that.
Which, and they also tell her not to do that, though, in fairness, because that's that famous conversation with her first lawyer where it's like, you know, you don't want to be hiring muscle to go around, you know, collecting money for you. You don't want to be doing drugs or anything illegal because it's dodgy, you know.
Yeah, but in that case, you're just breaking the law or breaking the law.
Yeah.
What do you want to do? Truth.
Yeah. That's the thing. I think it's, you're kind of in a bind. Sorry, Sandy, go for it.
I was going to say that it was wrong because it's the law. However, it's one of those things where you're looking at it and you're like, you know, what else could she be expected to do and in a way justified because of the fact that she wasn't using muscle? And it's just one of those things like, why is that a law? Like, why can't it be just, you know, a limited amount or something like that? It just seems ridiculous.
Well, that's the reason why you have to have a license to do to run a gambling establishment or a game, you know?
Why?
Whatever the limited amount could be set by law, I think she exceeded it.
Yeah.
Unless the law is like crazy.
Well, just one of those things you need a license for. Just like saying, why do you need a license to drive or serve liquor or whatever? You just do. It's the law. But, you know, for whatever the reason. And there are times, like I said, there's countless moments, I think, for me that she could have walked away and was clearly just, like I said, it makes a lot bigger of a deal out of it in the book and out of how, you know, even though it's not technically illegal, this whole thing is a gray area. The movie at least goes into a lot of the kind of, I guess, power dynamics and the power plays that are involved here, particularly when it comes to our kind of our infamous player X, Tobey Maguire, very probably. So, as I said, in the course of my research, I found out that it wasn't actually technically Tobey Maguire who took away the poker game from Molly. It was one of the other players, but that supposedly, well, so Molly says, he did actually call her to gloat, just as happens in the movie, and laugh at her and say, you know, you're truly effed because of it happening, even though he wasn't the one actually doing it. So do we kind of feel like, how do we feel about that power dynamic? Do we feel like there's a gender thing going on there, or is it, you know, famous person and not famous, rich and not rich? How do you feel about these dynamics and the way they kind of play into the story? Who should I ask? Let's ask you first, Sadi.
I think it's a big deal that at least, you know, certain famous people are alluded to and that we can look them up. That actually was a lot of the allure and interest to me, like how Adrian said it was a true story. It was less that than salacious details on these celebrities or, you know, financial geniuses.
Yeah. Although it has to be said, the movie is accurate in what it says, that she never names anybody who wasn't already public knowledge because of the bad Brad kind of Ponzi scheme case. So they'd already been named. And she presumably knows a lot more about a lot more of the other people that she isn't telling for whatever reason. So yeah, make of that what you will, I suppose. But like, how do you feel with regards to what happened to her in losing the game and the way that this, like, we'll call him Player X lest we get sued, and how this Player X kind of handled himself and what he did?
I was just as incensed as she was, I think. I was just so angry that, like, it's not like she didn't, while some elements of it came easy for her, she put in the work. And even though she did kind of steal this game from someone else, those people willing, like, she didn't make anybody drop that guy. I think everybody was kind of fed up with his attitude.
Yeah.
So it just made me angry that he just could take that away from her so easily.
Yeah. This is where I'm a bit blurry, because like I said, it was a few days ago that I watched the movie and I've just read the book, so I can't remember if it happens in the movie or not. But there's when she's kind of taken the poker game away from the guy who tries to take it from her, who's got different names depending who you ask, and I'm not going to use his real name because it's out there, but this sort of initial boss of hers, who's a bit of a jerk, when she does it, he kind of asks to meet her and she's apparently terrified. And then in the end, all he says is, oh, I'm very proud of you. You're learning, you're coming of age and whatever else. So it's kind of like there was no hard feelings there, basically, I should say. And he even kept turning up to the games that she was running and still playing and stuff. So it's not, I don't think, necessarily the same situation as, like you said, when it's being stolen from under her by this Player X, who, let's be honest, is portrayed in both book and movie as just using this to effectively ruin lives for shits and giggles, I suppose, for want of a better way to put it. It's not because he needs the money or wants it. He's getting off on the thrill of just, you know, upsetting people and winning this imagined kind of power play. And that says a lot about, like, what is this power trip in this guy's head? What is this, like, imagined thing where he's in competition with everybody? And like you said, I mean, it would take a psychologist to analyze it fully, but is this a gender dynamic thing? Or is it just, you know, he's a insecure person that wants to rail against the world? How do you feel about all of this, Adrian?
I don't think it was gender. I think he likes to ruin lives. He likes to ruin lives. You know, yeah. Some people have a small little non-sexual based sadistic chunk of themselves. And maybe that's what it is. I mean, you know, maybe Toby, or not Toby, or any Player X, maybe somebody had issues as a kid. Who knows? But
yeah,
I mean, as an adult, he definitely said, if it's true that he wants to ruin lives, he tried to ruin hers too. And other players. So
I don't know for sure about, well, we don't know what happened or what didn't, because it's all Molly's account, but certainly the book has the same scene, which I really like the scene in, as it's portrayed in the movie, where he's kind of, he basically bluffs his way into winning by just going, look, I've got you beat, man, I swear. I wouldn't lie to you. I wouldn't. And he has absolutely nothing and just basically was, ah, fuck you, and then walks off. You know,
that's, I mean, my picture. Yes, I loved that scene too.
Exactly, yeah. Which apparently, like I said, according to the book, did happen. So maybe it did. I can believe it, you know.
We're going to give that love to Michael Cera, though.
Yeah. And he plays a good part, but so... hurts my tummy, you know, when people are mean to each other, even though it is like a poker game and you did it on your own. I just wish everybody would be honest.
Well, it's never going to be that in a poker game, but I think, like you said, this Player X certainly brings things to a bit of a horrible new level. And like I said, there's instances that Molly mentions in interviews and in the book of this player, you know, waiting until he's, you know, really won a horrendously bad hand from somebody that they, you know, couldn't afford to lose or whatever. And even though it's technically, you know, their right to walk away, he was just doing it to be mean and kind of like, ha, I've now cost you $100,000 or whatever. I'm going home. I'm not going to give you the chance to win it back or whatever. And like mm-hmm. she says, like, it's his right to do that, but I don't think it was necessarily ethical.
Right.
You know,
the casting is interesting though, because there are lots of people that look like certain people who aren't named in the movie or in additional information that you can find online. And I have to wonder if she had a hand in the casting at all.
Or, as you said, supposedly she worked very closely with Sorkin and might have, you know, told him the names privately on, you know, on condition that he never share it. And he, or whoever he kind of tasked with being the casting director, was like, we can allude via some of this casting to some of the people that were there. But certainly there's lots more names. There's
even a character that looks like Zuckerberger. I mean, it's just uncanny in some situations.
That might be more of a kind of Aaron Sorkin, you know, patting himself on the back sort of reference, maybe. I mean, we started talking about it, so we might as well carry on. The portrayal of real people in the movie, you know, it includes obviously Player X that we've talked about, and a lot of the people that are named previously. So how do you feel about this portrayal of these people? Do you feel it's fair? Do you think it reflects on real life events accurately? And were you intrigued by it, I guess, is the big question. Toby, we haven't heard from you in a while. What do you think about all this?
Well, I mean, I don't know most of the context of real people, because famously, I don't care about celebrities at all.
Right, okay.
Like, everything I know about them, I learned by accident, or someone forced me info that I didn't want to know.
So that wasn't part of the appeal for the film? It wasn't like you
No, I didn't go to the movie and
somebody
think,
forced you to learn about stuff. You don't want to know all the drama in these people's lives.
Celebrities are actually not like us.
Well, not when they're, you know, this particular brand of, you know, they're so far removed from us. Like I said, film, book, and stories, you know, mention private jets, yachts, and everything. This is a world we'll never, ever see. I mean, hundreds of thousands of dollars that are being bet and lost, you know, at a time. I don't want to spend too much longer on the writing, because I think we've talked a lot about
I will just add that when you were talking about the non-linear story structure, that it does keep the pacing for me going very well. And I think it's one of the reasons that it is easy to sit down and think, I'll check this out, and then get immediately drawn in. The pacing's just so good, I thought.
Yeah, also, fair enough.
I think it offers the breathing room in between the, because the past scenes are very fast paced. And when we're in the present, it's like in this, like the dialogue is still in the fast pace a little bit. But in general, the scenes are more calm, more, you can have a little breathing room. You can maybe even reflect on this little portion you saw. And that's also part of what I think makes this pacing work.
Yeah. Personally, for me, I think it just keeps it interesting, because I was surprised to learn that the book starts in the same way roughly as the movie does, with Molly basically being woken by the FBI raid and the sheer juxtaposition of this insanity that she's kind of like, I think you've made a mistake. I'm just, you know, a 26-year-old woman, and don't hurt my dog that's in the other room. What is this about? And then says literally in the book, I got handed a piece of paper and couldn't see beyond the top of the page, which just said United States versus Molly Bloom. I have no idea what this is about. But I mean, hooking you in with something like that, or the skiing accident, which again isn't mentioned in the book and is very, I think, over-dramatized maybe in the film, to a point that it's made more of a big deal. But that's the kind of stuff that keeps you hooked in. And I think it was very smart of Sorkin to make sure that it plays like a, I don't know, like episodes of TV almost. Like there's at the end of an act break, there's something to hook you in and keep you, oh, I wonder what happens next. And I think the structure definitely aids you in that, speaking on the direction. So would you guys agree, or was there something else in the direction that you thought was particularly interesting?
I mean, in general, I think they're looking at what other people are saying. There is a general agreement that Sorkin should not direct his own scripts. And I would say I agree with this on the other two movies, but I think the direction in this movie is actually not that bad. And
I think he's a better director for me than he is a writer. His direction in this, I prefer to his writing of it, to be honest. Sorry, go ahead.
For this movie, fair enough. I think the other movies suffer a little bit under his direction.
Like, well, he hasn't directed anything other than this, as far as I know, has he? Or has he?
No, he has directed feature films, Being the Ricardos, and before that was Trials of the Trials of the Chicago something like that.
I've heard good things, but I've never seen that. Yeah, okay.
I mean, Trials is solid. Being the Ricardos is not good.
Yeah, fair
enough. It's boring. I mean, part of it is also that I just didn't care about the topic.
Yeah,
that's also a thing with biographies. If you care about this person, then
that's kind of where this movie lost me at times, was that, like I said, when it started displaying a world that I'm, you know, that is so far removed from me that I'll never understand or see. And I'm not just talking about playing the poker, I'm talking like the rich celebrity lifestyles and stuff. I was like, I just don't care. I'm glazing over because this means nothing to me. This might as well be, you know, somebody living on the moon for all of the connection it has to my life, and I'm not interested in it. Though I can understand how people might be, you know, but yeah, those were the parts that was kind of like, yeah, I just want to get past this, to be perfectly honest. But yeah, no, I liked the, as I say, we'll move on to the direction because we've talked about the writing enough, and I already did start. So did you guys kind of, ladies, you haven't kind of chimed in, how did you feel about Sorkin's direction? And do you feel like the non-linear narrative and the kind of rapid dialogue and the narrative pace, do you feel like it's a positive or a negative? And Sandy, again, you've already mentioned you thought it was obviously, it's what kept you hooked in. So Adrienne, how about you? How did you feel?
Yeah, it kept me hooked in. It was just like West Wing, and I totally loved that part. I just loved it. I was like, oh, wow. Okay. Because it's a long movie. So it was, I liked it. I
loved the dialogue. I know we touched on it there in the beginning, but I did like also how she was able to pull literary, references, like bringing up Circe and stuff like that, because she was educated, just like when in the club in the very beginning, when her first jerk boss hooked her in, he's like, look what I got, and look at you, you're just a waitress, knowing that she'd already, you know, gone through college, was looking at law school, that she was breaths away from being an Olympic champion, which is very condescending.
No, that's all absolutely true. And like I said, other than the fact that walking away from skiing was her decision to make because she wanted to focus on other stuff. But like you said, she is absolutely, you know, an intelligent, incredibly driven woman. She'd have to be in order for any of this to happen. There's definitely talent involved, you know. But does that say more about her ambition in the regards that it was kind of a poison chalice for her because it pushed her a little bit too far? Or do you think it's just part of who she is and, you know, she better live with it and maybe just put it to better use?
Both, probably.
Both. Yeah, fair enough. I think, yeah, that's probably the fairest way to put it. But yeah, I mean, for all that I don't believe necessarily all of the kind of saintly stuff, it's impossible to deny how, like I said, intelligent and sharp. And I mean, even just watching interviews with her and stuff, the real Molly, yeah, she's not dumb and she's not, lower class scum that you can look down on as much as she might be from a middle class family. And probably was a lot of that.
She also relied on and lifted up women along her way too, if that's how it did play out. And they in turn looked after her.
There's a lot of mention of, it's not so much lifting up because she does mention she kind of used them to shore up her business, but there's a lot of like bringing in Playboy bunnies and women that she knows can, you know, lure people into the games, particularly fish that'll lose a lot of money. But
they
were intelligent. Would never see them mistreated,
though. They were intelligent as well and had their own things to bring to it.
I wanted to say that as well. I don't care if this is real or not, but I really like that the movie showed how these other women she had, which were mostly like beauty pageants and models, or like, you know, people of that are often said to be dumb and stupid and just and that she showed, you know, at least for some of them, obviously not for all, this movie has a runtime, how they can actually bring something good to the table, to this quote-unquote company, to this game. Because there's like one of them, it's been a week since I watched this, but one of them is doing some like hacking, not hacking, but like background chats. And like she's doing something very tech. Let's just say
yeah, that. She was the code. And yeah, she could run writing background code. Checks better than the TSA.
Yeah.
And I really like that, regardless of if this is accurate, that she had a person like this. Like, this is an addition I support.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I can't speak to the accuracy of it, and it hasn't come up anywhere else I've seen when I've been researching. But I mean, it sounds plausible, and if not, like you said, it's a good kind of thing. And I believe it about Molly as a character, that she, like I said, she protected women an awful lot. You know, a lot of the time in her games and stuff. Nothing, I wouldn't say nothing illegal happened, because there were obviously drugs and shady goings on, but certainly there wasn't any kind of assault, and there wasn't men being allowed to do whatever they pleased and stuff. There were limitations. But it's interesting, like you said, that kind of speaks to the gender dynamics part of it, of like, these women, including Molly, I think, are aware enough of their sexuality to use it without using it in an exploitative way, and without kind of coming across as, I don't know, like lecherous or anything. It's kind of more, this is just another thing that I can use to further things for myself without using it in, you know, a salacious way. You know, they weren't prostituting themselves or anything, but
no.
They knew, you know, they knew who they were.
Important. Yeah. If we're talking about the movie and less about Molly, if she did that or not, these portrayals are important in movies. Not that it was perfect, but much.
Yeah.
Becoming seen more and more often these days, it can no longer be called subversive, but it is still somewhat rare.
Yeah, I mean, it's unusual for a movie to let women be attractive, you know, sexual creatures, and not be portrayed as like, in order to be good, you've now got to, you know, be wearing your turtleneck cardigans, your glasses and your hair up, and only be this. And, you know, this movie isn't really one that's interested in doing that thing. So you've got to kind of give it points, I suppose, for that. And because that, you would never have gotten far in the whole glamour world if that was the case either. So there's got to have been a degree of that. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, back to the direction, as I said, because we were kind of starting with that. I loved a lot of it. Like I said, I actually think Sorkin was stronger for me as a director than a writer here. Like, I love the kind of the chiaroscuro, you call it, the use of shadows and stuff during that initial arrest scene. I was kind of really hooked in with that. I absolutely adore the way that Sorkin portrays the LA scenery, because he makes it look just as kind of alluring and captivating as it must have been to Molly. And it really does look beautiful in this film. It's all framed at the best kind of times of day and looking gorgeous and everything. Or even Molly, like, overlooking the city on the top of the cliff or the mountain, and the way it looks kind of gorgeous all sprawled out there. Is there anything that kind of stood out from you in particular, like visuals or cinematography, editing? Any of you guys? I'll ask you first, because you probably know more than most on this.
I mean, one thing that I really love is the way the poker scenes are shot, where it's like you have different viewpoints and it's really fast and
changing perspective, so it's not like
changing perspective,
static exactly. Camera, yeah,
exactly. And they kind of have little editing time jumps in between, so it's not like real time and we just have changing perspective. No, they cut out all the dead air of these poker scenes, and that makes them really fun and engaging and exciting. And I think that's what the movie wants you to feel. It wants you to be also enamored by this world as she was.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
Maybe for different reasons, but still.
Yeah, and I think to your point, the camera often does kind of take in her point of view, even if she's in the shot of, like you said, looking at this, and even if they're not fully understanding, just seeing the allure and the sights and sounds and understanding enough of what's going on when it comes to somebody bluffing or the big stuff that you can kind of comprehend. Even if, like I said, I didn't love a lot of the scenes, I have no interest in poker, so even despite the best efforts to make it look exciting or put little graphics to explain what was happening and why this was important, I was just like, I could not care less. Really, I apologize, but I couldn't.
I like poker.
That's fair enough. Yeah,
not playing for money, please don't. But, you know, privately, like with friends or like online for non-money. That's fine.
Yeah. Well, fair enough. I just have no interest. Fair enough. What about you, ladies? How do you feel about, you know, the direction in general? Is there anything that stood out? Or
I for sure love the cinematography. I loved all the pictures of Southern California, Hollywood area. Mm-hmm. When she pulls over real fast to take that call, I'm like, okay, that's Fountain Avenue. I mean, it looked to me like exactly, that's what I thought it was, you know, like, oh, I've been down there, you know, like,
wow. I forget you lived the other day.
Well, yeah, it's just the views, it's exactly what it looks like.
That really is like another world to me. And I forget that's probably like around the corner to you.
I know, like, I'd say a half hour, maybe, you know, if I'm in traffic, it might be.
That's around the corner.
Yeah, so I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah, but that's very well shot of a scene. I mean, mm-hmm. and not that it's direction, but I think a lot of the kind of costuming, hair, makeup, styling and stuff is completely on point for the movie and has to be, because there's a lot of reference by Molly to how like she completely changed the way she looked. Mm-hmm. And I think you can tell a lot about where we are in the narrative, which helps the nonlinear thing, by how Molly looks as well, because yeah, the more different she looks to.
Exactly. I wrote down the names of the costume designer, her makeup designer, cool. and her hair designer to give them full cred, because that is one of the amazing things that to me about this movie. Just you can absolutely tell exactly what's going on by exactly how she is dressed and how she looks. And of course, her acting is great.
Mm-hmm. Anyway. Oh, completely. Yeah. So do you have the name, Sandy?
Oh, sure. Sorry. So for costume design, I give it to Susan Lydell. For makeup, it's Linda Dowds. And hair is Stephanie Ingram.
They all did fantastic.
Yes,
I have to say, it's not a surprise to me that all three of those are presumably females.
That was really cool. Yeah, I loved that part.
That's cool. Yeah, and I fully agree. I think it looks, you know, whatever you think. And I mean, not just the women in the movie, as I said, Idris Elba's sharp suits and stuff, or the way that the kind of celebrity guys are made to look like specific people, they invoke in your mind, like, oh, I bet that's such and such celebrity because it looks a bit like him or whatever. Even if they were, you know, the kind of people that only ever walked in baseball cap and sweats or whatever, you can still be like, oh, that's who that is.
And well, the money guys look like money guys, and the mob guys look like mob guys.
Well, it's funny because like you look up the makeup department from the movie and it has hairstylist to Miss Chastain and hairstylist to Mr. Elba, you know, like all these cool stuff.
Yeah, there usually is on any big movie. There's usually like personal assistant to the big star or whatever.
When you talked about the cinematography and how warm and inviting actually those poker games were, and how they kind of highlighted how good of a hostess she was, how comfortable she made them feel. Like, she even mentioned to that one guy who said he was in love with her. She's like, I'm like the anti-wife. I encourage your gambling. I encourage your bad habits. I don't, you know, talk bad about you. I make sure you have this, the fancy alcohol and cigars and snacks and pretty things to look at. Like,
And I mean, makes herself look a certain way as well, you know, so.
But it was very inviting.
Absolutely. That's movie style wise.
Also, I really like the differences between the hotel suite for the celebrities, and then was it also a hotel suite for, like, at least the room for in New York for the bankiers and mob? They were both welcoming, but in different ways for different people. And I really like.
Oh, she was renting out like the best of the best suites in the kind of hotels of LA to run the game.
And she had some in her home. She mentioned early on in New York.
Mm. Yeah. So,
said like she had the lower buy-in games at her home. Yeah,
to talk about the more unpleasant part, which is the kind of the assault scene, I suppose, on Molly by the member of the mob. And I have to say, it shocked me because it came, I wouldn't say out of nowhere as such, given the nature of what the narrative says, but it was quite surprisingly brutal. And you know, Sorkin deciding to frame it the way he does and film it in slow motion to really emphasize the brutality, I think made a huge impact on me. And you know, then just seeing Molly, you know, alone in darkness, in what is literally her darkest hour, just in shadow, kind of weeping, I suppose, was a bit of a shock to my system, but certainly powerful and effective. How did that scene kind of hit you guys?
I felt the same way. It her driver betrayed her by even getting her into this circle, by introducing her to these guys. Her doorman betrayed her by making sure she would open the door thinking it was the packages. There's all that betrayal. And even though she had the tables turned on her like that before, she was always physically safe. Even when people were losing their cool in her poker room, in her poker games, she was never injured. It never crossed over. She didn't use muscle to collect debts. Like, she was staying away from this circle of violence. And yeah, it was,
other than almost being hit by a bag of bagels, just to clarify.
Yeah, she ducked though. She missed that. She had good reflexes. But it was just as shocking. Yeah, it was really shocking. It was really brutal. I think also because, I mean, of course, it was a man. They weren't going to send over a hit girl. But yeah, it was just very brutal. And that she didn't want anybody to know. She recovered by herself. That there was no justice for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although I did kind of like, the strongest part of the film are towards the end. And I kind of liked it when Jaffe uses that to say, you know, nobody wants to see the mob brought down more than the people in this room, least of all the only one of us who's got actual, you know, reason to be offended because she was physically assaulted by them. You know, and it's kind of like, yeah, no shit, exactly. Come down off your high horse kind of thing. But yeah, so what about you, Toby? Were you affected by that scene? Was it a shock?
Yeah, I don't think the movie says how much time, because she meets with them guys, and it's pretty clear they want protection money. Like, that's
yeah.
So I wasn't surprised that the assault happened, but at least the movie puts that pretty, not directly after this. I think there's like one or two scenes between, but like it's very close to it. And the movie doesn't really say a timeline, like how long that took. It feels very fast.
Yeah. I'm not shocked that it happened. I'm more shocked at the way it was portrayed, because it's very rare that you see the kind of cold, brutal reality of it. And it's not something, fingers crossed, that I've ever had to experience. So I'm not like au fait with how, you know, you would be personally assaulted by the mafia in that way and then have a gun put in your mouth, I guess. But I was just surprised how much of it Sorkin decided to show. My point, not so much, you know, oh, it's a shock that it happened. It was more like, wow, you really are showing every inch of this.
And the closeness between these two scenes, I think was the shocking part for me, because it's like they moved so fast. Like, I just assumed it was close in the timeline, because there were a lot of stuff between these two scenes. So that was a strong part of me, how close they got to her, you know, got to her driver, got to her doorman, and how quickly they could get into her circle to do that to her.
I see what you mean. Yeah, like to get access in that fast of a way, even though it's not shocking that they could do that. We've probably, you know, anybody with any knowledge of the world knows how these things sadly work. But yeah, that's fair enough. Adrienne, do you want to add anything to that? Or I know it's not a very pleasant thing to discuss, but
I walked out of the room.
Okay, fair enough. I can't blame you, to be honest. It was very intense. I think not in a bad way. I don't think it was exploitative, or, you know, it wasn't filmed for cheapness, but it was very brutal, and it brought home the reality of it.
Yeah.
And it was kind of the beginning of the end.
Yeah, of course.
It changed the tone big time.
Oh, yeah. How do you feel like, Chastain, how do you feel her portrayal was? Do you feel like she changed during the course of the film? And do you think she played these kind of defining moments well? Toby, I'm going to ask you.
I didn't realize that this way before leading up to this, you sent a bunch of interviews and I looked up into it and I was like, wow, this is uncanny. The way she can, because Molly Bloom has, in the interviews at least, she has a way of speaking where she's very fast and then slow and then has certain breaks. And And the way I just thought by just listening to this, how it's exactly the same. The same parts she speeds up her talking. The same parts she takes a little break. And the same parts she slows down a little. And
so you would say you can probably tell that they spent time together and that Jessica Chastain probably did base at least some of the mannerisms and her acting on the real person, because she could. So yeah, I think they don't look a million miles apart either. Like, Molly is genuinely quite an attractive woman. She could be a movie star, you know. But yeah,
I read that she wanted Jessica Chastain to play her.
I can see why. I mean, she's attractive, but she's also a great actress when she's not doing an X-Men movie. So, ladies, how do you feel about Chastain's performance? Sandy, I'll ask you first.
I thought it was really good. Besides acting the parts that needed acting, she was able to look very, pensive. Like, you could see gears were turning in her head when she was thinking. You could tell when she was caught off guard by something, when she felt determined about something, like she was not going to do it, or she was going to do this, when she felt low, when she felt high. I got everything from her performance, and I thought it was really, really stellar. And the other performance that kind of stuck out for me was the gentleman that played Harlan. His name is Bill Camp, Harlan Eustace. Right. When he is having that bad poker night, and he goes from his usual calm self to, chain smoking cigarettes, and you could just see the tension and frustration just under the surface. It wasn't even a big performance, but it was a big performance. I thought he was really great too.
Yeah. Since we're shouting out the quote unquote smaller roles, I have to say I was really impressed with Chris O'Dowd, as well as the guy who's kind of, like you said, was supposedly in love with Molly and mistook her for being Irish because of her, connection to the James Joyce character.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that's the same, idiot from the IT Crowd who plays that role, but it is. And I think
I loved the portrayal of him too, as his opening line always sounds like it's a detective novel, like gut shot. That's very Sorkin.
I could have lived without that, to be honest. That's very just Aaron Sorkin showing off.
Oh, I loved it so much.
Just like all these hilarious quote unquote nicknames and stuff that everyone gets. I'm like, all right. There's a certain degree where you're just being pretentious or offensive, and we don't need it. You know what I mean? But anyway, that's not an acting thing, though. That's, as I said, that's an issue I have with Sorkin, I think. But I love Chastain in the movie. I think she's a great actress. Like I said, with one exception, I think she's been great in everything I've seen her in. Shout out to Interstellar in case Will's listening in, because otherwise he'll kill me. So I'll move on to the others later. But how about you, Adrian? How did you feel about Jessica Chastain in the movie?
I don't remember seeing her in anything before, so she really blew me away in this one. I think she stood up really wonderful with all these other actors, and I think that she was great in it.
Yeah, I mean, the two kind of main male roles in the film, Idris Elba and Kevin Costner, both fantastic for me. Costner it's a difficult role because I kind of dislike him, but I'm supposed to, and it's a difficult thing to play. Whereas Elba, contrary to that, I think is the strength and the heart, particularly the end of the film. He gets all of the kind of punch the air moments, as I always call them, and like, yeah, exactly, you show them, you say all the right things and stuff. And Elba's just a fantastic actor and gives a great performance. It's mm-hmm. undeniable. He's smooth as butter, and so it's hard not to think, there's a reason this guy's an actor. He's charm personified. But yeah, so how did you feel about this?
I guess I'm taking it.
No, go for it.
One of my favorite scenes of his is in that very first courtroom scene where he says, I'm just showing up here to get you through this first part. I am not your attorney. And how he keeps swapping beats with the bodyguard that, he's struggling with, is he going to represent her or not? And keeps asking her questions. You can see him struggling with it before he finally comes to the decision, at the last moment to represent her officially. And I just really liked that scene.
That was another one that was a bit too Sorkin for me. It was a bit too staged.
Yeah. Honestly, I thought it, after a certain amount of switches, I was like, we get it.
Yeah.
It got really annoying.
Yeah, it gets old fast.
Well, it helps because even she was like,
it's next time. It's stealing my time.
even the character Jessica Chastain was like, really? Like, you're going to switch seats again?
I was also really unclear what had finally sold him on the idea of taking the case, because I didn't really hear it what was being said. And
he asked her why she didn't sell her debt sheet. She had all that money. She obviously needs money. Why didn't she sell her debt sheet? And she said, because I wasn't sure. I didn't know how they were going to collect. He was like, I was afraid you were going to say that. So, you know, because she was afraid that these people would be hurt. It wasn't worth it to her. And then that's what changed his mind.
That's kind of what it. Yeah. When I looked it up, it was like he was basically he was suckered in. Well, that's okay. He was lured in by her morality and kind of was drawn to that, which, again, kind of a little bit, ooh, what a saint you are at times, but when it comes to that character, it's understandable in its way. I think he's allowed to, being the kind of wholly fictional part of the movie. How did you feel about these two actors, Adrian?
Oh, I love them. I kept watching Idris Elba's acting because I didn't know he was in the movie. Honestly, I didn't research it at all. I popped it on and I stood up and I go, what? Like, you know, when and I was so excited. So I was like, hey, Toby, because I had no idea. So it was great. And I kept rewinding and stuff. He's just so great.
So what about you, Toby? How did you feel about Idris or Kevin Costner?
I mean all the praise to Idris Elba, and I wanna agree with everything that has been said, but I think Kevin Costner is so amazing in this scene at the end, in the park. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, yes. Oh, it's a great scene. It's a fantastic scene.
Yeah. You almost got rid of him for being a jerk dad.
Yeah, it's got my favorite line in the movie, that scene.
Well, don't say it yet, because we always ask that at the end. But
oh no, I always forget that this is happening. Every time the same.
Well, that's your little warning then, because I don't know how many times you've been on this. You should know it.
Yeah, and I will always forget. It's becoming a running joke at this point.
Fair enough. Sandy, you didn't really mention Kevin Costner, but I know that you particularly were affected by that sort of father-daughter psychology session, I guess you could call it, impromptu on the bench at the rink there at the end. So. Any thoughts from you that you wanted to add?
Just that it was very cathartic. And while her motivations weren't exactly ever really clear, even to herself, I think. And I had mentioned that's what really kind of brought the film home for me. It was just about her growth. And I mean, she was never really as smart and intelligent as she was, and she never really seemed very introspective, and just like kind of like the meeting of those two worlds, her drive, her ambition, with almost like unlocking a secret key of being able to see her motivations laid out so plainly, and the service that did for her, and you know, some very strong words I've seen from her in interviews that are almost like should be embroidered on a pillow or something. You know, she's just learned so much, been through so much, and adding in that bit about herself that she was probably, you know, blind to most of the time, because, you know, she didn't want to hear what her father said. You know, she always fought with him all the time. But then, like I mentioned, he was like the key to unlocking her real potential. I just thought that was this really good scene.
Yeah, so you appreciated the kind of, obviously that was, well, it was key to her personality, as you said, whether it be real or not, it's key to the character in the film's journey and personality and self-discovery ultimately at the end. So
it is, and a lot of critics didn't appreciate that scene. They said it felt out of place, that at first they thought she was hallucinating her father being there, which I didn't get at all. Well, at first I thought when he showed up, you know, in the rink with his head over, which causes her to fall, I did think that was hallucination. But when he's sitting there talking to her, you know, I no longer thought that.
It was one of those things where I was like, there's no way this happened. It would be way too much of a coincidence for her to walk out at this particularly stressful time, have no money, trade, you know, expensive gloves for skates. And then at that exact moment, her dad just happens to be there. I'm like, there's no way this happened like that. I mean, they probably did have that conversation, but it was very like cinematic in the way it's presented that I don't believe it was that particularly. What's the word I'm looking for? It wasn't that lucky, I suppose. It was that fortuitous.
Yeah. Of course, but it also would be boring for a movie to just have a call that's like, let's meet up.
like a call from your dad. Let's come round and we'll have tea and sit on the couch. You know, it's not as exciting, is it? But yeah, fair enough. The last thing I want to mention then, because we haven't really mentioned it in terms of the acting, very quickly, shout out to Joe Keery from Stranger Things, who plays a very small role in this, but I thought was very good.
Trust fund call.
I like that. Yeah.
And we kind of have to mention, I've got to say, I feel bad saying this, but we've got to mention Michael Cera, who I think was woefully miscast in this film. I do not know what they were thinking or what they saw in him to portray this, I don't know, complete jerk of a character, because maybe it's because that, you know, supposedly the people that it's based on, or the person that it's based on, is kind of, you know, has this affable, charming front and this kind
exactly.
of.
Exactly. That's, you know, why I think.
Yeah, but for me, it just, he didn't sell it because he didn't have any of that edge. And I just, you know, I can't not see like the comedy guy or the, you know, the young son from Arrested Development or whatever. And I'm just kind of like, I don't buy any of the harsher moments here with this actor. I think he could have cast somebody better.
When he had that conversation with her, like, maybe we should look at capping your tips. And that's $10,000 that didn't go into my pocket. It's my money. I found it very believable, you know, despite, you know, seeing him in other things. I saw only this character in those moments.
Okay. So, yeah, any last thoughts on anything before I move us to the kind of audience thing and then our kind of favorite moments in conclusion?
can I go back to very earlier in the conversation? And so someone said that the scene with where she speed up changed the tone of the movie, and I do want to add, it not only changed the tone, it also completely changed the pacing of the rest of the movie, mostly because the movie got really fast at that point. Especially in the past scenes, it wrapped up very quickly after that, and that kind of shows her spiraling into this. And
yeah, that was kind of the thing. I think that's kind of when you run out of the material from the novel that they adapted, and it's kind of, they don't have anything to base it on except her actual recollection. So I think that's why it's fast, is that like that's the 3 years between finishing the novel and making the movie, where they don't have anything to base it on. So it's kind of like, and then this happened, and this happened, and this happened. And it kind of, you know, we know from Game of Thrones, when you run out of material in a book to adapt, you don't do well, particularly. So,
yeah. But even in I mean, I guess that's also an accurate reaction of hers, that after that, she quickly wrapped everything up. But so does the movie not take time to really show. Because there is a way that they could have made more of this whole FBI thing, and could have prolonged this, but they chose not to do that. They chose not to really get into that, but instead really show how she's panicking and how she's wrapping everything up. And then at the end, she doesn't even get to stop on her own accord. That, not even that works out. And I just feel like how the pacing changed from that moment on to be really wrapping everything up.
I see what you mean, and yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say it. So your issue is really with the pacing, I think, in that case, because it's not like it's a short movie. I think Adrienne alluded earlier, it's 2 hours and 20 minutes, so it's not like it didn't take its time. But as you said, it's, without making a 4-hour movie, you can't then start getting into the, you know, those 3 years in depth as well, exactly. Unfortunately, but like you said, perhaps it could have, you know, condensed some of the earlier things to give us a bit more time with that. And I totally agree with you. I think I still don't understand the whole FBI situation or what was going on there,
but I think it really for me it really showed how she's panicking in this situation after she got beat up. She's she's quickly trying to get out of this.
And
the pacing of the movie reflects that really quick get out of this.
Yeah, it's also the point where the kind of non-linear narrative catches up. So everything from that point on is linear. You know what I mean? It's like,
but that's what I said, that there are still things they could have focused on, like the FBI stuff. They could have focused on that. They could have,
yeah, you
know, take 10 more minutes to get into that, but they chose not to because they want to have that effect.
Yeah, there's also a degree of like how much are they allowed to if it's an ongoing case. They might not really be able to get into it, but like I said, I fully don't understand it, so I kind of wish they could have. But no, I don't. I think to your point, though, yes, it does kind of somewhat. I thought of it as changing the tone, but I think it probably does because, like you said, it brings home that it's not all glamour and you know, the allure of the shiny things and everything in this world, and this is the other side of it. You know, this. It's not so pleasant, and she kind of had to learn that the hard way, so which sucks. But yeah, all valid points completely. Anything else anyone wants to add? I know that I didn't ask a couple of you about Michael Cera, so any thoughts on that as well?
Yeah, I wasn't a fan of Michael Cera's acting, but I don't think I've really seen him in anything else, so it's not his fault he had to play a big butthead.
Fine, right. So I'm going to move on then, and as I said, this would be the point where we always go to our audience response. I always ask our audience on social media and stuff what they think of the movie. Didn't get a lot of responses, so I'm just going to read them out myself. And apologies again if you're used to hearing DK or somebody else doing this, but we don't have a lot to add. And I did have to kind of peruse a few friends on Letterboxd and a few other reviews to fill this out a little bit, but I have some things here anyway, all the same. So I'm going to jump into our audience response, as I said, and I only have one response from like the traditional social media, and that's from Rick Cowling, who just says, I thought it was quite an engaging film with a few good plot twists as well. I don't know whether Rick knows that it's based on reality or if he thought it was just a plot that was twisting. We'll see. From over on Letterboxd, as I said, from some of my friends, first of all, Michael Stark gives the film 3.5 stars and says, fine, but overlong. I'm still cool with the Sorkin dialogue, but after a while, it just gets tiresome. I hear you, Michael. Alec Greer gives it 4 stars and says, a solid drama with outstanding performances from Jessica Chastain, Idris Elba, and Kevin Costner. Agreed. Citizen Chris gives it 3 stars and says, in Aaron Sorkin's feature film directorial debut, we got the outstanding writing we've come to expect of him. Rapid-fire dialogues, detailed explanations, comparisons, and clever lines make a movie about poker games more captivating than you think. Jessica Chastain is at the top of her game, and this is her show. She's the driving force, and she delivers the lines in virtuoso fashion. Her scenes with Idris were electric and eye-widening. If you don't know poker, it's very easy to get lost in the poker portion of the film, yeah, which makes Molly's game run longer than anyone might like. Yeah, I hear you for the end part there. PLD, my friend Paul DiNuzio, gives it 4 stars and says, pretty much classic Sorkin. I'd put Chastain and Elba together anytime. Their give and take with Sorkin's dialogue is golden. Is there anyone that can play an unlikable character yet make him likable easier than Kevin Costner? I have no idea about the truth. If someone has more invested in the truth of Molly Bloom, they may hate the film. Not being a naive person, I'm assuming the film, based on a book written by Molly Bloom, is going to put Molly Bloom in the best possible light. I just don't care because I'm viewing it as a story. With that in mind, it succeeds in giving me interesting characters in interesting situations. The only drawback I must point out is Michael Cera. I like Michael, and I understand his role was basically as Tobey Maguire, if rumors are true, allegedly. But he just took me out every time he was on screen as not being believable in his role. Overall, though, a good film. It won't win awards, but it's a fine watch. Yeah, I kind of agree with you on Cera there. And finally, a slightly longer one by Mark S. Sanders, who reviewed this on his own blog. I've condensed it a little. He just says, despite being a little distracted by a drunk patron sitting next to me, I thought Molly's game was very good. It doesn't measure up to The Social Network, and I feel justified comparing the two because the sharp, fast dialogue follows what appears to be an intentionally similar narrative from writer and here director Aaron Sorkin. Sorkin, in his directorial debut, uses great techniques for film editing to match the beats of his dialogue. His opening voiceover of Jessica Chastain as Molly describing the ultimate worst sports experience will get your heartbeat racing. It draws you into the film right away. None of these actors were the worst options for this cast. I just think the film could have used more appropriate performers. There was more apt talent out there, I'm sure. Idris Elba is great, however. He's blessed with an awesome Sorkin monologue in the third act of the film, and he hits every note. Agreed. A great script, a great story worthy of being a big screen film, and it got me interested to learn more about the real Molly Bloom, including reading her novel. Yeah, me too, Mark, as I said. So yeah, that's all of the feedback we got from the audience on this one. So it is that time where we put all of us on the spot, but none more so than Toby, who keeps forgetting to do this by asking our favorite character moment and line. At least I do in mine. I know DK doesn't in his cult classics as much, but I like to do this in my reviews. So I'm going to go around and ask for everyone's favorite character, first of all. I'll go counterclockwise so that Toby can go virtually last and give him time to think. So first of all, who was your favorite character in the film Adrienne and why?
Molly Bloom is amazing. Well done.
Okay. Is that all you have on that?
Yes.
Molly, amazing. Cool. Right. What about you, Sandy?
Taking the... If a favorite character and favorite line are tied, I am going to go back to Chris Dowd, because I just really liked his lines coming, sounding like a detective novel, and that, gut punch on the river. I thought that was so funny. And probably my favorite one from him is where he said, there's a famous poem about thoughts left unexpressed. Two roads emerged from the woods. Do they explode? I don't know. You like poetry? And I just thought that was
it's the way she responds, I did until a couple of minutes ago.
Yeah. I thought that was really good. And I just love that character was given that idiosyncrasy to make him somewhat endearing.
Yeah. So Chris O'Dowd's character was your favorite, yeah?
Yeah, of this, besides the obvious Molly Bloom, which we've talked a lot about.
Yeah, that's fair enough then. And what about you, Toby?
I'm going to go with Molly Bloom, just because I think the portrayal is just so well done. And I'm surprised that she didn't get more accolades of this performance. Like I get why this movie didn't win like Oscars as like best movie or something. Like I totally get that this maybe isn't the kind of movie for that, but I think her portrayal was so good. I think she should have nominated for something.
And I said, even though I now know that he's not real, my favorite character was Jaffe, because he's a moral guy, a good dad, which we haven't talked about. I like the way his interactions with his daughter, and he recognizes goodness and innocence, whether it's kind of real or not. So yeah, what was your favorite scene or moment in the film, Adrienne?
Well, I really like the scene where Idris Elba is talking about, do you think I'm a good father?
Yeah.
And she says, do more, keep going. Cause she talks a little bit about her own life. You know, I just love that part. I guess my favorite moment is when Dad says, I knew you knew. He remembers seeing her as a 5-year-old, maybe probably her expression of seeing him in his car with his mistress.
Yeah.
And that was really heavy for me. I thought Kevin Costner really just, that one moment was so great.
Yeah, I can see that for sure. Sandy, what about you?
Again, my favorite scene, I did bring it up earlier. I talked about all my favorite stuff, I think. But that scene in the courtroom with Idris, mm-hmm. when he was trying to decide to take her case or not, and kept switching sides with her, and he knew like this was his last moment to really make this decision, and it's almost like he did want to take the case before he knew about it, because he suspected she was good, and his daughter was also, you know, telling him, you need to read her book, you need to read her book, and you know, she was a hero to his daughter. But it's like he was giving her every opportunity to convince him, and until he was. I just thought that was a great scene.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, fair enough. Cool. And what about you, Toby?
Well, it's difficult for me to put on any... Like, I want to say the ending scene where she meets her father, but that's going to be my line, so I don't want to be double that.
Fair enough.
I think I'm just going to say... Honestly, most interactions with between Molly and her lawyer, where we kind of get into why she's acting the way she's acting, and the scene where she says, "This is my name. This is all I have," and you know, this also the scene where she says, "I don't want to." Different scene where she, "I don't want to wanted to settle debt cheap because I don't know what happened." I just think every time they interacted in a way that highlights why she acted the way she acted, these scenes together are my favorite scenes.
Awesome, that's well put. I'm going to accept that because you put it very well, and I can see where you're coming from. I was just very basic. I literally just said the father daughter therapy session on the bench next to the ice cream.
Yeah. Totally.
My favorite scene.
I can totally see that. Yeah. It's going to be my line, so
I'm not. It's not mine, unfortunately. So I have got a slightly different line than that, but I can see why you would. Yeah. So, what was your favorite line then, Adrienne?
Still just the "I knew you knew." That was my favorite line.
Got you. And have we had yours already, Sandy?
We did the poem.
Fair enough. Toby, go for it.
My favorite line is not, it's not because the line is that amazing of a line. It's just the way this is portrayed. And my favorite line is basically the whole therapy session. But I really liked in the end when her father is like, "They're gonna suffer," and it's like 3 or 4 times he said this and breaks down, and that really got
yes
me.
Yeah,
oh yeah,
that
yeah
was heavy because she probably never seen affected him that way before.
Yeah
It's the way that Costner portrays the genuine, like you believe his emotion at finding out that she was assaulted from, you know, her book, and like, why did I have to hear about that, and they're gonna pay for it, and he finally becomes the kind of protective dad that she probably always wished he would be, you know. So yeah, it's very, very effective and emotional. I completely agree with you on that one. But my favorite line is actually from Judge Foxman at the end, and it is, "This courthouse is located within spitting distance of Wall Street. I know this from my personal experience trying to spit at it. The men and women who work there will commit more serious crimes by lunchtime today than the defendant has committed in this indictment." Well, our chips are all in. We've called, and it's time to show our hands. So, with our conclusion and score out of 5 stars, Toby, I'm going to let you finish and go last because you can bring us home since it's your choice of movie. You get the joy of finishing,
no pressure,
so to speak. And Adrienne, I would like you to go first, please, and give your conclusion and score out of 5.
I was really glad that I watched this movie because it was a true story. And now I'm all intrigued and keeping up with these people and all the stuff that they got involved in. I give it a 3.8 out of 5 stars.
So very random. Okay, I highly recommend the book in case you hadn't already guessed from the amount of times I've mentioned it. But yeah, fair enough. What about you, Sandy, then?
I really appreciated this movie's themes of failure and getting back up, because that's something I also struggle with, is being like just afraid to take risk or take chances because of that fear of failure. And so I appreciated that from this film. And also the positive portrayals of women in general. But it's just not really a subject matter I'm super interested in. And I'm trying not to let that color my thoughts of my ultimate score, because I thought the dialogue was really good. How it was shot was really good. I like the casting all the way through. And so I give it a 3.8.
Same as Adrian.
We are twins. We had no idea that was coming.
Awesome. We didn't. And I kind of zoned out for a second. So that's a surprise. I didn't know we both got 3.8.
It's good to know you're listening. Anyway, then. So yeah.
The trees are pretty.
I know cats are cute.
I know I say this a lot, but apologies for my long-winded conclusions. I will get these down eventually and learn how to, you know, be succinct. But I just
said, no way, you make it interesting. We like to hear them.
I'm not sure if the audience agrees, but we'll see. I said a bit of a mixed bag for me, this one. I'll be honest, for a lot of the runtime, it was hard to find anything that was going on all that interesting, as it simply wasn't remotely relatable. I glaze over at the mention of poker. I've never seen the sums of money that were involved, and the glitz and glam on display are something I'll never see. The script also leaves a bit to be desired. It's often long-winded and pretentious, and honestly, it's not that easy to even understand what the heck the specifics of the case here even are. The film is also, in my opinion, horribly paced, far too long, and focused too often on the wrong things. But that's the negatives out of the way. On the positive side, it's beautifully directed, especially for a first-timer. The performances are all great, but particularly Chastain, who carries this film on her back. It's also compelling. I really wanted to understand. And honestly, the stuff about Molly the person was far more interesting than the case against her and where the film truly shined, even if sometimes the almost saint-like elevation of Molly was rather difficult to believe. The ending was very emotional. I just wish the whole film had the same impact as the last 20 minutes or so. All that said, I enjoyed watching it, don't regret it, and can see myself definitely watching again sometime, as I'm at least interested in this true life story. There'll be people, I suspect, who love this, but it just didn't quite connect that way with me on this first watch. As I said, though, I can definitely see myself watching again and potentially the score going up. But for now, I give it 3.5 out of 5. So, yeah. Hopefully not too disappointing for you, Toby. And because it was your choice, I'm going to let you bring us home with your conclusion and score on this.
Well, as anyone knows, I don't buy DVDs or Blu-rays or anything. And I bought this DVD.
Cool.
And I not only bought this DVD, I bought it like the first time I saw it in the store. I was like, I need to get this movie. I need to buy this. Full price. Yeah, so I think that tells you everything you need to know about my enjoyment of this movie, that it's like one of the like 10 movies I have a DVD of.
Wow, okay.
Or Blu-ray. I don't want to repeat everything I was said before, and I completely agree, and I don't think I have anything else to add. Well, I disagree with you on that, on the dialogue, but someone else here didn't, so I agree with that person. I forgot who it was.
It was me. I wonder, though, I do have a question for you. Was it the filmmaking aspect that drew you to it, or did it speak to you on some level? Like, what really made you love the movie?
I think it's really just the, in a way, the aura of this movie, like the way it feels like you are in a high stakes game. It feels very energizing, and I think that's really something I love about this movie. And I also love, obviously, all the deeper stuff in this movie. But I think what really drew me in, at least on first watch, like, what was the energy of it. And the more often I watch this movie, and I watch it like 5 or 6 times, which for me is a lot, the more I can also get into the deeper stuff, into the character. But that's not something I usually get into in the first watch, at least not in a movie that presents itself so. It's with so much energy. It's almost like an action movie in a way. Like an action drama in a way.
Right.
Yeah. It's action-y, definitely.
Yeah, there's no direct action except this one beat-up scene, but it feels action. And
yeah,
that's what I really like.
Mm-hmm.
My score is, everyone knows I am always score inflating everything. I have way too many things that have way too high. It's a 5. Let's just get it over.
5 out of 5 for you.
That's nice.
But I have so many movies that are 5 out of 5.
Aw.
And
talking about the deeper meaning, it was no throwaway that they brought up, you know, the Crucible and Circe and, mm-hmm. and things like that. This is very, very interesting. You're right. There are many layers to the movie.
Yeah, that's fair enough. Okay, so... yeah, we will add those scores together, divide by the 4 of us here to give us our final overall score, which brings the final score for Molly's Game to 4.025 out of 5. We'll just say 4 out of 5. I think we'd round that up. So, yeah, I think 4 out of 5 is a very good bloomin' score, frankly, and mm-hmm. you can't be too disappointed with that, Toby, I don't think.
No disappointment. The inflation worked.
So, as the final cards hit the table, Molly's Game proves ultimately to be a cinematic ace. Sharp, stylish, and thrilling. Jessica Chastain, we've agreed, dazzles as the queen of the underground poker world, and Aaron Sorkin's dialogue deals out the drama with precision. So whether you're a fan of high-stakes action like Toby or just enjoy a well-crafted character study, we can safely say this film is a sure bet. All that remains then is for me to say thank you so much. I've had a really genuinely good time discussing this movie. I really enjoyed watching it and, you know, launching into the true story and delving into the research for this one. So thank you, first of all, Toby, for suggesting it and taking part.
No problem. Oh, I was supposed to say something.
Thank you, Toby. Yeah, thank you, Toby. I'm glad I watched it.
Yeah, I love how much we
even talked about this movie before the recording.
Yeah,
I don't think that ever happened.
So, yeah, we've been discussing this on our Discord page even before we recorded.
So like, oh, these people are actually enjoying this movie. That's good.
Yeah,
that's fascinating. In defense mode.
Fair enough. So, do you have anywhere that you want to shout out where people can find you on the internet, Toby?
I mean, as always, my Blue Sky account, because I don't care about Twitter. No, it's not I don't care about Twitter. I just don't post on Twitter anymore because people are just getting nasty at me, and I don't want that.
It's already now no longer in functional in Brazil, so it's only a matter of time before it disappears, I think.
Yeah.
We'll see.
So my Blue Sky account, it's Dark Sonic and Blue Sky, and I write occasionally, like every couple of days I write something.
No problem. I will always put the kind of things in the description, the links for all of the guests. So thank you again, Sandy, for joining us for this one.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you to Toby for bringing this to me.
Thank you again, Adrienne, for joining us yet again for another episode. And I'm pleased you had fun.
I did. And I've barely started to peep back into Twitter, AL Park Tucker 2. But mostly I'm just hanging out on Discord's miscellaneous ones, and this is a fun one. So
cool. I will always edit in the little card on screen with all of our details where you can find myself, the podcasts, and if you wanted to reach DK, we'll always forward on the message, although he's not here this week. Hopefully you've enjoyed that, and feel free to comment if you have your own opinions, even though you didn't contribute to the audience response. Feel free to, you know, contribute after the event, or maybe you want to watch the film and then let us know what you think. We would be glad if we've kind of turned you onto this and pointed you in the direction of a film that you also are interested in. Happy to discuss it with you in on any of the social media places or on the YouTube comments. Personally, you can usually find me around in the same places. It'll be in the link tree in the episode description, all my personal social medias, as well as the ones for the podcast. So, yeah, hopefully, as I said, you've enjoyed this discussion. I thought it was really good, and hopefully it's been compelling. And even if you haven't watched the film, maybe you've enjoyed. We'll wait and see. Join us again, because we're always coming out with new episodes. I believe our next episode after this is going to be one of my cinema classics. We're going to be looking at the classic original King Kong, the second of our monster kaiju crossovers. Closely followed by looking at the third part, the original 1954 Godzilla. So a couple of huge monster things to look forward to there. And then in October, DK is hitting us with his month of monsters. And I will leave that hanging as to what that's going to entail, because lots of surprises. And we are going weekly, so there's lots of episodes. Everything hideous and macabre. So come back for more of that in October.
Sounds fun.
Awesome. And yeah, thanks again to my guests. Thank you if you've made it this far listening. And we'll see you next time. In the meantime, remember, you don't want to break the law when you're breaking the law.
You've been listening to the Silver Scream Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson, produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Scream Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Cut!